Three, two, one, sync. Well, what I remember most is how it became the center of community for the internet as a whole. Now, the internet is a term which means a lot of different things, and there have been many sort of generations of the internet, but long before it came upon the public eye, which happened, I guess, in the early 90s, there was a large community of people who were building the internet and building high-tech tools, and Usenet was an online conversation place, an online meeting place. It was the place where things happened, where things were announced, where people got into fights, and where people met and made new friends. Yes, I think so. The Well, of course, actually came on a little bit after Usenet, but it was a very popular sort of early online community, and it had many of the same effects. Now, The Well was a single central system. Usenet was a distributed system which existed on thousands, eventually hundreds of thousands of different computers all around the internet. So it looks a lot like what people think of as a bulletin board, and sometimes it's called a message board, although it's all done with custom software. And in those days, people didn't have the always-on internet connections all the time. They didn't have anything like the web. They had a thing called FTP for file transfer if they were on the ARPANET, as it was originally known. And so what would happen is there'd be a program on your system, and when I say your system, I didn't actually typically mean your personal computer, but rather a server that belonged to an organization you were part of, a company, a university, or some of the earliest ISPs. And you would be able to put a message on that system, and it would go and talk to all of the systems it communicated with. And it communicated with them over the internet, and it also used regular telephone modems in many cases. Anyway, your system would tell two friends, and they would tell two friends, and they would tell two friends, and it would spread out exponentially until it flooded out to all the computers on the network, as I said, hundreds of thousands of them. And then anyone could go and ask their own local system to show them the new messages about the topics of interest. So you could go in, it was kind of like a big giant shared email box. You could go in and see what was new about cars or computers or sex, any topic you wanted to talk about. So email, in fact, was the first place that online community began. And Usenet was created in some ways actually to duplicate that, but also to replace what many computer systems had in big companies and universities, which was a facility for doing announcements and news. In fact, you'll sometimes hear Usenet called news groups because its original purpose was to deliver system announcements and news to the people who used, in those days, a common time-sharing system or a computer network. So this system allowed you to broadcast out a message to everybody and started for news, but it quickly became used for conversations. Now, one of the differences with an email list, you actually have to join it, and there has to be a central machine which sends the mail out to all the people. You can kick people off the list, and you can control who's on it and even control who reads it. A news group was done sort of in a more public form. The material went everywhere, and people read it. You really couldn't control who read it, and you couldn't even control who posted to it most of the time. So it was a little bigger and a little more free-for-all. Well, I grew up in Canada, and Canada had not been connected to the internet as much as the U.S., and so when I was doing a summer job down in California, I first ran into Usenet, which was in 1981. It's about a year and a half or so after it got started. And I was just amazed by this. It was sort of a realization for me that perhaps the real purpose of all these computers and all these computer networks was for people to communicate with each other. So I started gathering up the science fiction news group in particular, because I was a science fiction reader, and sending it back to my friends at the university back in Canada where I'd come from. And they liked it, and when I got back there, I tried to work to see if we could get our university connected to Usenet. And so we played a little trick, which was there was a large computer company in those days called DEC Digital Equipment Corporation. Of course, it's now owned by Hewlett-Packard. One of their machines was very generous and was willing basically to use DEC's giant phone bills to call people in remote places and get the information through to them. And this is going over the phone, not over the internet. So we did that. Another fellow at Henry Spencer did the same thing in Toronto. These turned out to be the first trans-border network links in sort of the history of electronic conferencing, which is kind of cool. But the neat thing was that by getting this to happen and getting the software in, all the people at the school got hooked on it very quickly. And it was a classic case of asking for forgiveness rather than permission. Because once everybody was hooked, there was no way that the administrators could shut it off, even though it got used for a lot of frivolous stuff as well as the serious stuff. Yeah, there were all sorts of things. I mean, I have a long history of involvement with comedy on the network, and one of the very first popular news groups was one where people would share jokes. As you expect, they ended up sometimes sharing more than jokes and yelling at each other and yelling about the jokes. This caused me, in fact, to get banned, and maybe I'll tell you that story in a further incident. But people were always worried about what would happen when people encountered off-color jokes, and there were some cases of some people who were not too familiar with the network running across it and suddenly discovering a bad joke and, filing complaints. And the early dawn of the political correctness era certainly played a role in there. You will have seen in these mailing lists and in the news groups the dawn of things that have become very common, such as smiley faces and phrases like flaming, which came from the comic book character Johnny Storm saying flame on when he was going to go attack someone. People would say flame on when they were going to get angry, and that's where that term came from. You got to see all of these things born. Actually, by looking at the history today, you can see the etymology of many of the computer world's terms and phrases just by tracking back how people use them in open conversation that got recorded. Actually, no, people were quite shocked when they first started realizing this. I mean, everyone knew it was possible, but the volume of material was more than most people thought would want to be recorded. So it's actually kind of interesting because it developed a character of being both written and ephemeral. So you people online act in styles that are very conversational, more like how they'd speak in a meeting or on the telephone with someone, as opposed to the way they would if they were writing a letter to the editor of the newspaper or something else they thought was going for big publication. So, in fact, when people did these very casual and conversational and sometimes emotional and aggravated writings, they got a little shocked when they realized later on their words might live forever in infamy. Indeed, in fact, because I maintained this one, what used to be the most popular news group on the net, one devoted to jokes that was edited for content rather than, and by the way, for content, when I say that, I say edited to how funny it was, not whether it was offensive or not. But I maintained this news group and have for many years. It's now, I guess, started in 1987, so it's going to come up on its 20th anniversary. Anyway, I do get requests now from time to time from people who see that the archives are up on the web, on my own website, as well as, of course, on things like Google, and they ask me, could you please take my name off? I wrote that when I was young and foolish and in school, and now it's the first thing that shows up when you type in my name. So they do get, that's what bothers them the most, actually, I think, is when something shows up first before anything nice that they've written. Well, in the case of this particular news group, I had very explicit rules setting out to people if they were submitting material that they were giving permission for publication. So they don't get to make a complaint about that. I haven't seen that, but understand that publishing something does not remove its copyright from you. I mean, just because you publish something, in fact, that's kind of the purpose of copyright law is to allow you to retain rights over things after you put it out into the world. Yeah. Now, sorry, go ahead. You want a business story? I have a business story. Well, it's interesting that from my own in my own life, Usenet became the genesis of my business, which was the first dot-com business to appear on the internet. I had been publishing these jokes for several years and had seen that one of the most popular writers among people on the internet was the humor columnist Dave Barry. And people were constantly typing in his column from the paper and mailing it around. And that was not entirely official, but it built up quite a following. And so I decided that since I was spending way too much time on the internet and on Usenet, I either had to find some way to make a business out of it or stop doing it because it was sucking away my life, as many people have seen. So I contacted the syndicate that published Dave Barry and tried to ask them if they would let me publish it online legitimately and pay them a syndication fee the same way newspapers did, and they didn't really know what to think about that. However, they knew a little bit about what online meant because companies like CompuServe and Genie and some of these early online services that existed, they were islands, though they weren't this interconnected internet. That's right. Well, no, actually, not Prodigy, because that's where the story gets amusing. which is that now I went off and I couldn't get Dave Barry, but I said, well, you know, maybe there's a business to be made publishing other stuff. And so I went and actually made deals in the meantime with big news wires like UPI, and they were big back then. They're not so hot anymore. And a number of other sources, and started putting together a real business to build an online newspaper. But I went back about 8 months later to the Tribune Media Organization, that's the Knight Ridder company that published Dave Barry's column, and I called them to ask again. And this time, the receptionist said, let me put you through to our vice president in charge of online sales. So I said, well, that's quite a change. When I got through, it turns out that the Prodigy company, which had been founded by Sears and IBM with what in those days was a very large investment in trying to build an online service, had come in and wanted to buy columns, and they had offered huge sums of money, and they'd come in and said, we want Howard Cosell to do a column for us. And the agent said, don't be ridiculous, Howard Cosell doesn't even light a cigar for less than $10,000. And they said, okay. So they didn't even blink, so he realized he'd asked too low a number. But they had the kind of money to spend on that, and suddenly they were much more interested. Now, amusingly, many years later, not so amusing for me, but many years later, they reversed their position and they actually pulled the column from me, claiming they were worried about piracy, but in fact, about 6 months later, they ended up releasing it free on the web themselves, and it was free and is still free today. Well, Dave Barry retired a few months ago, but it's still free. So people could not figure out what to do in terms of business on that. Anyway, that business became, as I said, sort of the first dot-com business, the first company that was built to use the internet as a platform, and grew for many years until I sold it. Yeah, absolutely, people felt that way, and that even predates Usenet. I mentioned that before Usenet, people on the ARPANET did have mailing lists where they had discussions, and these were actually the model for bulletin board systems and online services and all of the chat systems that came after them. And one of those mailing lists was indeed devoted to what does all this mean? What does it mean for people to be able to communicate over computer networks? And even back in the 70s, they had a concept that they called WorldNet. That was the term internet hadn't really come about. And WorldNet was this giant network of computers that were going to be connected, and everywhere you went, you would be able to do things using this WorldNet. And people talked about it all the time, and they knew something very big was up. I mean, for me, I encountered Usenet and the internet working at a company which at its time was quite famous called Personal Software, or VisiCorp, and it published the VisiCalc software. And many people will remember VisiCalc as the first spreadsheet program was sort of the thing which made the PC industry happen. It made PC software into a business. And so here I was working, I consulted on development of VisiCalc, I was writing other programs for these people at the very dawn of the PC industry, and that sounds pretty exciting, but as soon as I saw the internet, as soon as I saw Usenet and other things, I said, you know, forget these spreadsheets. This is what computers are really for. And I've had that vision for, now for a long time. Well, actually, there's tons of ways to get into Usenet, and almost every ISP will offer Usenet access. There was a bit of a storm recently because AOL decided they would stop doing so directly. So you can go to your ISP and you'll find it's not as commonly documented because it's been sort of eclipsed by the web in popularity. But if you go to your ISP, you'll find where they say how to set up a Usenet newsreader. And there is a Usenet newsreader built into the Microsoft Internet Explorer and Outlook program that you may have, or the Mozilla web browser, which is also very popular. And there are several others. And you can set them up and tell them the name of the server at your ISP. And you'll be able to read Usenet directly from a reasonably local machine. If you can't do that, there are companies that offer access, and finally, you can browse it through the web on Google, though that's kind of the wrong way to do it, because I think a large part of the difference and the reason that Usenet has survived now, many, many years later, in spite of all the other innovation that's gone on the web, is there are a few core things that make it different. One is most people read it locally, so it's really, really fast. And it's hard to really understand the difference between something local and something far away and how important it is once you get used to having it fast to keeping it fast. And the second thing is that it's giant, and the tools that read it, these news reading programs, they're custom designed for that purpose. And so they do a better job, most people think, than reading through a web browser interface does. No, I mean, actually, well, I don't think Usenet is shrinking, but it's definitely not growing at the rate that it had been growing until the web caught the public's eye. So, no, it's not afraid of more size, although there's a significant, I can't ignore that there's a significant number of people on it who use it now to trade, binary files, including some that are copyright violations and some that would bother certain people in the, American Family Organizations or whatever the groups that pushed for censorship of indecent material on the net. But there's still plenty of other stuff going on. I mean, if you want to find sort of the place to discuss a whole bunch of different TV shows and all sorts of topics, it's still there on Usenet. I think it is. I mean, and the reason behind a decision like that is that while the internet has grown tremendously, Usenet hasn't grown as fast. So the percentage of the users at a given ISP who want access to Usenet on a relative basis is shrinking. And of course, these ISPs, they make their decisions based on, how many of our customers will we be pleasing by providing this feature, and so whether we should spend money on it. AOL decided that that wasn't right for them, but most other ISPs are still the other way. It certainly could happen, although the web was of course, or HTML at least, was a sort of a complete replacement of Gopher. And so, on the other hand, if you actually ask Tim Berners-Lee about his definition of the web, and he's the man who coined all the terms, he always included Usenet as part of the web. There was the HTTP pages, to get into the technical term, although everyone's heard HTTP by now. And there, in fact, you can type in, instead of HTTP on any web browser, you can type in news colon. And if you are set up for Usenet, it'll go and read, for example, news colon, a news group name like rec.humor.funny is the one I make. If your news reader is set up, it reads it. So web links point to it. So it's all sort of part of one big thing. It actually amazes me, though, that because Usenet has not innovated a great deal, I mean, it pretty much looks the same in many ways than it did in the late 80s. And that's sort of astounding that something that's that old and without improvement would still be around. And for some reason, the web interface just has never really done a big conversation well. When you go to these web message boards, they don't even do some of the most basic things in many cases, like realizing you've already read a whole bunch of stuff and you don't want to see it again. You want to see only what's new, the way your email tool shows you. Doing really well with giant threads where you've got, hundreds of people in a conversation and they're all going off in all sorts of different directions in a thread. That's also done much better in the dedicated tools than the web interfaces do. And I don't know why, actually, the web interfaces have stayed behind in that area. It may just be a matter of tastes, that there's some people who love it one way and other people who love another way, and there will always be that division, and so there will always be tools to meet both demands in the market. But it's still there now. It's in fact sort of a perennial joke to predict its demise. I became somewhat famous for making up a catchphrase about that because I wrote a history of Usenet and the internet back in the 80s. And after I'd finished the history, and it was really just a point by point, here are some things that happened, I decided just for fun that I would go in and every 10 lines I inserted the phrase, imminent death of the net predicted. So, basically, you could see, and it was true that even from the earliest days, people predicted this thing is going to die soon. It's going to get too big, it's going to get too expensive, it's going to get too noisy, it's going to have too much spam. Whatever's going to happen, every year there was someone predicting that death was going to happen at any moment. And here we are, 26 years, almost 26 years later, still hasn't happened. So it's very dangerous to make a prediction of its doom. Yeah, I think people are a little bit concerned about that. I think the Internet Archive, which is basically a foundation, sort of trying to protect a public trust, is going to do a pretty good job. So I'm not as worried. Of course, I know both the Google people and the Internet Archive people personally, which not everyone does. So I think that it would be nice if there were more people out there doing it, and there may be more. I mean, of course, it's common speculation that the various spy agencies were no doubt archiving it too, although they wouldn't say that in public. Sure. Well, during the dot-com boom and craze in the mid-90s, a company called Deja News decided that they might be able to make a business out of providing access to Usenet and archiving of it. And they put that business forward, did okay with it. It was pretty easy to raise money for a business back then, as everybody remembers. However, they didn't hit upon quite the right business model. They were sort of hoping they could, you know, put up ads on it the way that Google does today. And they eventually decided to sell their business, and it was pretty much at the right time for Google to come in and do it. Now, Google had already been archiving, as had a couple of other companies like AltaVista, which is another big search engine, which has sort of fallen by the wayside. Actually, that was from DEC, the company I spoke of earlier. A few others have been archiving it, but Deja News recruited all the people who had been making private archives, and there were people mostly in universities who had decided they would do backup tapes of the Usenet news. Most people, when they would make system backups, as all good administrators do, figured that the Usenet news was so ephemeral it wasn't worth backing up, but there were a few people who did. So all of those tapes were collected together, and Deja News used them to build its archive. Google enhanced that task when they decided to buy that business. And they went out and found even more archive tapes. Their archive still isn't complete, though. There are still little holes in it, and some of those holes may be lost forever. So that story goes back to, again, my decision to create a news group devoted to comedy, and I had made as a statement of principle that we would judge the jokes that were submitted only on whether they were funny or not and not whether they were politically correct. Now, on top of that, I had a computer program that basically randomly picked a joke from the pool of jokes that were ready every day to go out. And through sort of a horrible misfortune, I wouldn't even really call it that anti-Semitic a joke. In fact, I'm of Jewish ancestry, but a joke that was deemed that way happened to come out on the anniversary of Kristallnacht. Now, okay, I can understand why someone would get upset about it. And it got a student at MIT so upset that he went on a campaign to get the news group banned. And most people laughed at that campaign because there's a pretty sort of anti-censorship crowd among the computer network pioneer people. But he managed to get the university I was from, which was also my connection to the world, to indeed ban it, and also Stanford University down here in California. And so that happened a little bit later. So both those universities instituted bans on the joke news group and tried to shut it down. Now, of course, as soon as they did this, tons of people volunteered to be an alternate connection to the network for me instead of using the university that banned it. So the material was never blocked from getting out to the outside world. In fact, at the university, I just did this little South African thing where every time there was a joke that was even potentially offensive, they got a blank joke that just explained that that the university had asked that they not be shown anything that might be insensitive. So and that technique actually over time worked, and the bans were reversed. This sort of concept, I don't know if it predates or it's around the same time as what's become a famous aphorism for the internet, which is that the internet perceives censorship as network damage and routes around it. That's right. So the fact that one university, and even though it happened to be my only link at the time, one university decided to ban a particular news group, it really had no effect. People jumped up and the connections were restored. And of course, when the internet's working properly, that happens automatically without human intervention. But that was one of the first sort of big stories about attempt at censorship. And of course, there have been many others, and it was in part because of that that later I became a plaintiff before the Supreme Court in the ACLU versus Reno case, which struck down the Communications Decency Act in 1996, which was a passed law that attempted to ban indecent material on the internet. Yeah, no problem. Usenet doesn't get covered too much these days. Well, of course, Google, sensitive to that, does allow people to ask that their postings not be searchable in the archive, and that was also true at Deja News and some of the others. And they've also put up a principle that if people put a tag on a message, that they will keep it there only for a few weeks, sort of that reflecting the traditional history that the postings did disappear after a few weeks, and then they don't let people come and dig out your history. However, if you think it's totally gone forever, you may be deluding yourself. Yes. Yep. All right. Oh, so not an FTP, but an A. Because that. Should I stop recording now, by the way? You won't need the voice after this. Okay.